Pseudopod, episode 159, September 11th, 2009. This week's story, Reservation Monsters by Jim Baillet. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast that washes your whites with the blood of the innocent. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Jim Baillet. Jim's a non-fiction writer for publications like the Navajo Times, Arizona Highways, and High Country News. He grew up on the Navajo Reservation and returns there regularly to work as an oral historian. This story is part of an upcoming collection set on the reservation and based on the coyote stories. Your narrator this week is Ben Phillips. So, ignore the scratching and try not to think about what side of the door the scratching is on, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Reservation Monsters by Jim Baillet. By the third night, Kendrick knew there was a monster under his bed. The first night began with a dull scratching sound that lasted 5 minutes, like a bone dragged across the hardwood floor of his bedroom. The second night there was a huffing sound, like a horse breathing through a bit. Kendrick had buried his head beneath his pillow to deafen the noise. When a roadkill stink filled the room, Kendrick crept with his Pendleton blanket past his dad's bedroom door and slept on the living room floor. He might have slept well there, if not for the heads his dad had mounted on the walls. His mom had called them da-heads, but his dad had named them for the calibers he'd used to hunt and kill them. There was .302 Bighorn next to .330 Mule Buck, flanked by a .223 Pronghorn and .22 Kit Fox above the stereo system. At the head of the room loomed .30-06 Elk, his 12-point antlers spread like cottonwood boughs. Kendrick had fallen asleep on the floor that night knowing that .30-06 Elk would have no trouble keeping his glass eyes open. He nearly called for his mom, a reflex reaction he'd not yet grown out of. But his mother, Leanna Chandler, had been gone since February, nearly a month ago. After 2 o'clock that morning, Kendrick went back to his bed. 5 minutes later, a long, musical cry rose from beneath his mattress. Kendrick sprang to his feet and cupped his hands to his ears. He studied his dad's door, looking for a sign that his father had heard the strange noise that sounded like a cow's moo blended with a train whistle. But his dad had likely finished off his usual Budweiser six-pack dinner, and Kendrick knew he always slept deeply afterwards. He'd been drinking a lot since his mother had left that winter. He'd also drunk a lot just before she'd left. The mooing train whistle came again, less muffled, fetching air like a brush fire. Kendrick nearly screamed when he felt the casters on his bed frame shifting. Something was beneath. Then came the arm. The dim light from the hallway landed on a skinny, pale limb that wandered eagerly from beneath the bed. It grew twisted, angular, jagged, its long fingers ending in dangerous, tapered points. It waved back and forth, stiff with tension. Kendrick pressed his head against the wall hard enough to dent the plaster. The arm didn't move like an arm at all. It was an antler. Another antler rose as the monster emerged, its tawny back bristling with long strands of granite grass and sagebrush that seemed to grow sideways from roots in its spine. Its long arms stretched out on knobby hinges that pulled its impossibly bulky form from under the bed. Kendrick felt his bladder let go when he saw the monster's hands. Each hairy finger had at least 5 joints that ended with a miniature hoof where a fingernail should have been. The monster turned its face toward Kendrick, and he saw .30-06 Elk staring right at him, glassy eyes unblinking. The roadkill stink swarmed over him as he rolled away into darkness. The next morning he rose early, tore his stinking sheets from his mattress, threw them in the washing machine, dressed, and walked out over the crusted snow in the morning darkness to feed the horses. He dressed for school without waking his dad and walked to the bus stop. The bus was crowded as usual, but Kendrick had space to press his thick Chicago Bulls jacket against the window and catch 30 minutes of sleep. School passed in its usual blur of state-mandated subjects that had been well diluted for the Indian Reservation students. Most got their free lunch and were eventually bussed home that afternoon. Kendrick didn't mention the monster under his bed to any of his friends, just as he hadn't mentioned that his mom no longer lived at home. Besides, everyone knew the story. His mom's fellow nurses at Sage Memorial Hospital in Ganado, Arizona, had seen her leave after her evening shift in her dark blue 1998 Dodge Ram and then drive south on Route 191 toward home. And no one had seen her since. The Navajo Nation police had searched along Route 191 and Interstate 40 for her truck, but stopped when Kendrick's dad had found a note in his mom's handwriting in her jewelry box on her dresser. It was a neatly folded slip of yellow legal pad paper with four words written in blue ink. "I want out, Leanna." Kendrick had found the note in the trash the next morning and stuffed it under his mattress. After the school bus pulled away from his stop, Kendrick turned to walk home down the mile-long dirt road. He had taken five steps before someone called to him. "Walking alone today?" He turned and saw a skinny old man standing on the other side of the highway, his hands tucked into the pockets of his denim jacket. "I'm the only one at this bus stop," Kendrick said. The old man adjusted his straw cowboy hat and stuck out his thumb as he walked north along the highway shoulder. "You walk alone every day?" he called back. "Yeah?" Kendrick shouted. "Me too," the hitchhiker said. Kendrick shook his head, shouldered his backpack, and walked. After a half mile, Adrian Rowan Horse and two other teenagers wandered out from the thick junipers near the dirt road. Kendrick sucked in his breath and tried not to run. Adrian had been expelled from Chinle High School 2 months before and had moved in with an uncle near Ganado until the Chinle School District would allow him to return next school year. In the meantime, Adrian and his buddies prowled the government housing at cornfields, broke into cars when they needed money, shot horses or sheep with stolen rifles when they got bored. His dad had kicked the boys out of the trading post at least twice. Kendrick picked up his pace. The three teens laughed loud and fast through the lollipops hanging from their mouths. "Hey, it's the half-breed," said the tallest boy, adjusting his Metallica baseball cap. The teens' awkward stumbling and slurred speech and the smell of cheap Carton Deluxe wine in the air told Kendrick that the boys were probably drunk or high or both. "Hey, apple boy," Adrian said, stepping through the sagebrush to the road. Kendrick had heard it all before. Half-breed, chief vanilla, and apple boy. Red on the outside, white on the inside. It's what happened on the res when your mom was Navajo and your dad was a white man. "Got any money, Kenny?" Adrian said. "His dad got money," said the shorter boy. "That means Kenny's got some." Kendrick looked along the highway, but the slim old hitchhiker was already more than a mile away, walking with his denim jacket pulled tight against the cold. "No money. I'm broke as a bad joke," Kendrick said, one of his mom's favorite phrases. "He's got that there," said the tall boy, pointing at the silver and turquoise bracelet that circled Kendrick's right wrist. "I bet that's worth a trip to the pawn shop." Kendrick shook his head, but Adrian was nodding. "Kenny," Adrian said. "You give us that bracelet or we'll beat the shit out of you." When Kendrick had turned 10 years old, Kendrick's dad had commissioned the bracelet from a local silversmith for Kendrick and his mom. The bracelets had been identical, a looping design set with four evenly spaced turquoise stones. "Two of a kind," his dad had laughed the day Kendrick and his mom had opened them. Kendrick wore his every day. He didn't know if his mom still did. She had gotten out, after all. Kendrick knew he would die trying to keep the bracelet. Adrian had it off of him in about 5 seconds while the tall boy held his lollipop. Adrian pointed to Kendrick's white ranch house ahead. "I bet there's some money in there, Kenny," he said, turning to laugh with the others. "You should invite us in. We could be your friends that way. And friends share their things, right? Nothing bad has to happen that way, huh?" Kendrick stumbled up from his knees, caught his breath, and shook his head. "Daddy's not here to help you, so you can let us in now, or we'll just go in for ourselves," Adrian said. "Or maybe tonight when you're asleep." "Maybe light some things on fire after we leave," the shorter boy said, shifting his lollipop to the other cheek. The taller teen laughed. "Maybe," said Adrian, unfolding a long steel flip blade knife that reminded Kendrick of a bear claw. "Yeah, maybe, Kenny. It's up to you now, how half-breed." Kendrick knew the old hitchhiker was too far to hear him if he cried for help, but then he wouldn't need it now. The sound of tires tumbling over the dirt road and a trail of rising dust announced his dad's Chevy Silverado as the truck tore down the rutted road and braked 20 feet from where Kendrick stood across from Adrian and the boys. His dad kicked out of the Chevy with the nickel-plated .45 automatic pistol he'd carried during his 12 years in the Marine Corps and kept in the truck's glove compartment. He aimed it at Adrian and his two followers. "Don't run," Kendrick's dad said, pulling a wooden axe haft from the pickup bed. The tall teen was taking the lollipop from his mouth to protest before Kendrick's dad smashed the haft into his solar plexus. The shorter boy stepped forward as the haft collided with his temple. He spun stupidly into the sagebrush next to where the tall boy choked for breath. To Kendrick, it sounded like hoarse breathing. "Why you got to pull a gun, white man?" Adrian said, adopting the gangsta posture of flashing hands and bobbing neck. The flip knife rested easily in his left hand. Kendrick's dad slipped the .45 into the waistband of his jeans and tossed the axe haft to Adrian. The teen dropped his knife to catch the haft, both hands along its neck, ready to swing it like a baseball bat. "You'll need that," Kendrick's dad said, his long flannel shirt flapping against his thin frame as he stepped toward Adrian. Adrian swung for the neck, but Kendrick's dad ducked and swept to the left in one fluid move, driving his palm into Adrian's stomach. He waited for Adrian to breathe in for air before he smashed his elbow into the teen's nose, knocking him to his knees. Bowing Adrian forward by his greased hair, Kendrick's dad aimed the teen's bloody face toward Kendrick. "What's this boy's name?" he asked. Adrian didn't answer, so the white man drove a knee into his chest. "What's this boy's name?"
"Kenny,"
Adrian wheezed. "No," the man said. He backhanded the teen across his bloody face. "What is his name?"
Kendrick, Adrian said.
"Kendrick Chandler." The man yanked back on the teen's hair, so they were now eye to eye. "What is my name?"
"Kendrick Chandler."
"You're damn right, Adrian. And if anyone touches or messes with Kendrick Chandler or any of Ken's things, the only reason Kendrick Chandler will have to call the Navajo police is to tell them where they can pick up your body. And if anyone touches my son, I won't have to do any looking, Adrian, because I'll be coming right for you. Do you get me?" He made Adrian Roanhorse put his mouth over the .45 automatic while he took the turquoise bracelet from the teen's front jeans pocket. Then he cocked back the hammer on the pistol while he ordered Kendrick to run forward and kick Adrian in the balls. Kendrick shook his head.
"Do it," his dad yelled.
Kendrick did it, and Adrian pitched to the sand, groaning. Ken Chandler fired twice in the air, and Adrian and his friends ran like jackrabbits back into the junipers. "You gotta watch out for those boys. They're real monsters. Only one way to handle them," his dad said. "You hurt?" he asked, picking up the axe haft and pocketing Adrian's flip knife. Kendrick shook his head. His dad slipped his graying blonde hair back from his weathered face and tucked it back behind the rim of his straw cowboy hat. "Good," he said. Then he walked forward and slapped Kendrick across the jaw hard enough to make him stumble. "You pissed the bed again last night, didn't you?" Kendrick nodded. "When you replaced the sheets, you overloaded the washing machine and left it tumbling. Now I've got to get it fixed. And now your mattress stinks to hell and back. Now walk home while I pull up. Feed and water the horses and the sheep. Then take some soap and water to your mattress. God almighty, Kenny, you'd think you never had a mother to tell you these things." "I did," Kendrick yelled, snatching the bracelet from his dad's outstretched hand and running to the corral. He dropped alfalfa hay to the horses, then wheelbarrowed hay to the sheep corral. As he turned to unravel the hose to water, Murphy, his dad's blue heeler, walked out from behind the corral where he'd been napping. He flexed his front legs forward and bowed into a yawning stretch. As he lifted his back legs to finish his stretch, Kendrick ran forward and kicked him in the ribs as hard as he could. That night, the roadkill stink announced the monster. Kendrick backed into the corner as the granite grass and sagebrush along the creature's bristling spine shivered with each of its emphysemic breaths. Despite the paralyzing terror, he sensed a new life when the creature looked at him, as though the cold glass eyes had been exchanged for warm, rubbery eyeballs that now jerked and twitched as they scanned the room. Kendrick noticed something he'd not seen the night before. Two arrows pierced deep into the monster's chest and side, nearly to the feathers. The wounds leaked bright blood. Kendrick held his breath against the roadkill stink as the monster tilted back its head and bugled loud and shrill. His teeth vibrated against the sound as he clapped his hands over his ears. The monster's antlers swept over his dresser, scattering toy cars, little league baseball trophies,
and the framed photograph of his mom after she'd graduated her nursing program at the University of New Mexico. He heard the glass crack and remembered the first time the frame had been broken last Christmas, when his dad had thrown it at his mom during an argument over who they were going to visit during the holidays. That night, Kendrick had held a hand mirror while his mom pulled small shards of glass from her lips and nose with a pair of tweezers. The monster's grotesque hands pressed against Kendrick's chest, like soft velvet, holding him down with a familiar gentleness. The creature leaned over, its wet, dark eyes working in the sockets. It parted its furry jaws, coughed an inhuman chirp, then vomited something cold and grainy that spilled over Kendrick's chest and neck like sand. As he brushed the vomit away, Kendrick realized it was sand. The monster croaked and vomited again, and sand ran over his face and into his hair. That was when Kendrick started screaming. Ken Chandler stumbled into the room, 45 automatic cocked and aimed, and found his son hyperventilating in his bed. He shook the boy, called his name, until Kendrick clutched his father and wept against his shoulder. Ken holstered the pistol, brushed sand from Kendrick's hair, and asked what had happened. Kendrick tried to speak, then mumbled something about a bad dream. As he tried wiping away his tears, his dad noticed something in his hand. He pulled the boy's clenched fist open and found the crumpled wad of legal paper that read, "I want out. Leanna." He must have reached for it as the monster emerged from under the mattress. His dad took the note, told Kendrick to sleep in his room for the night, and walked to the kitchen where he burned the note over the gas stove. The next day, Kendrick ate his Apple Jacks, hustled through his chores, and walked to the bus stop. Because he had broken the washing machine, Kendrick's dad made him carry his stinking sheets and clothes in a swelling mesh laundry bag to school. There, he hoisted the sack over his shoulder between classes, and after the final bell, walked a mile up to the laundromat connected to the gas station along Highway 264 that ran through Ganado. The gas station laundromat was a common fixture on the Navajo Reservation, a place of local gossip, sprinting, unsupervised children, gumball machines, and dirty floors, where rib-thin res dogs, drifters, and drunks gathered for the free heat and the chance to beg for handouts. Kendrick split the laundry by colors into three heavy-duty washers, got a can of Coke from one of the vending machines, and sat with the mesh bag against the wall. He tried reading a homework chapter from his American history textbook, but his eyes seemed to slip closed on their own. He hadn't slept more than a few hours in the past few days, but he was aware enough to move the laundry from the washers to the dryers along the wall after the timer buzzed. He slotted in the quarters, watched the clothes tumble against the large plastic portals, and felt his eyes drifting closed again. When Kendrick returned to his seat, he didn't notice the hitchhiker until he had sat down next to him. "Ya'ate shihe," the old man greeted him in Navajo. "Hello, my son. You still walking alone since we met on the highway?" He removed his wide-brimmed straw hat and rubbed a hand through precisely cut white hair that had once been blonde. His thin, angular jaw was stubbed with several days of gray growth. Wire-rimmed glasses seemed to float over the man's strangely colored eyes. They were as yellow as pine gum, flecked with tips of green along the iris. His skin was the same tan color as Kendrick's, the color of a half-breed Navajo. Kendrick didn't answer. His mom had taught him, if you talked to Delaney drunks, they just asked you for money. Instead, he sipped his Coke. "Good thing your dad showed up like he did," the hitchhiker said, brushing back stray strands of white hair from his forehead. He was without his denim jacket, a dirty flannel shirt and worn jeans clung tightly to his skinny frame. But the man didn't smell. Delaney usually reeked of a mix of cheap whiskey and caked vomit. This man smelled like fresh deodorant and shaving soap. But Kendrick still would not give him an answer. And how did the hitchhiker know it was his dad who had stopped Adrian and his partners? He could not have been close enough to see them. "I can tell you don't want to talk with me," he said, crossing one sand-faded boot over his thigh. "But I just wanted to be sure you weren't hurt. Those boys were rough with you. It's always a shame. But I'm glad you got the bracelet back." Kendrick nearly choked on his swallow of Coke. The hitchhiker had been at least a mile away when he'd seen Kendrick attacked by Adrian and his goons. He couldn't have seen them take the bracelet. "What?" Kendrick asked. "How did you see?" "With my eyes," said the hitchhiker, grinning like a coyote, revealing perfectly white, gleaming teeth. "You could say I've always had good vision. I know enough to see that," the hitchhiker said, pointing ahead to the transparent portal of the dryer staring back at them from the end of the row.
That's your machine, right?
Kendrick nodded.
Better check it. Looks like something could be wrong.
Kendrick looked ahead at the dryer. White socks and t-shirts tumbled behind the glass. But the sound was different, like rocks tumbling or gravel shaking. He stepped closer to the dryer portal. When a dark, rigid object passed in the tumble, Kendrick knew what was making the noise. It was a hoof tumbling in the laundry. An elk hoof. Kendrick ripped the dryer door open, and warm socks and t-shirts tumbled out onto the floor. He grasped into the laundry for the hoof, for the physical proof he could take home to his dad that would explain his sleepless nights and his piss-stained mattress. His frantic hands found nothing. The hitchhiker whispered into Kendrick's ear from behind.
Didn't find anything, huh?
Kendrick started and turned, but the hitchhiker was still seated. No, Kendrick yelled over the tumbling noise in the machines. There wasn't anything there.
But there was before you opened it, he said.
And I could guess this isn't the first thing like this you've seen, right? Kendrick nodded. And you probably haven't been sleeping much, my son, he said.
Kendrick nodded again.
The hitchhiker walked to Kendrick and knelt before him, placing his hands on his small shoulders.
When I was your age, I ran away from school all the time. The tribal police would gather all us kids up from the Hogans and the cabins, haul us to the boarding schools, cut our hair, tell us not to talk Navajo, feed us flour with bugs in it, all that crap you hear about now in documentaries. I ran away to my auntie's house near Canyon de Shelley. She was a seer and a hand trembler. The Navajos around there, if they couldn't sleep or they were sick, they sent a runner to my auntie and she came with her rock crystal and her corn pollen and went over their home until her hand trembled like she was holding onto an electric fence. And she saw things, visions no one else could see, the sort of visions you're seeing now, the things that cause sickness, death, things that have to be dealt with, things that have to be sung and prayed over so the person can be healthy again. The hitchhiker produced a cold can of Dr. Pepper from behind his boot and handed it to Kendrick. Kendrick accepted it, popped the top, and drank deeply.
There's a monster under my bed, he said. The hitchhiker nodded.
What kind?
Kendrick whispered, happy for the blurring background noise of the washing machines and the sudden sweetness of the soda as he described the creature's knobby limbs, sagebrush back, antlered head, its shifting eyes, how it had vomited sand, how its face had changed.
And how do you know it's a monster? The hitchhiker said.
Huh?
Monsters exist to hurt us, and this creature hasn't hurt you, has it?
Kendrick recalled the soft velvet of the creature's hands on his chest and shook his head.
No, it hasn't hurt me.
If it's not trying to hurt you, the hitchhiker rubbed his chin, then what does it want?
Kendrick shrugged and turned back to the dryers along the opposite wall. His clothes had stopped tumbling, and the sky was yellowing towards sunset outside. His dad would be here soon.
Do you think it's a Chindi? Did someone die near your house?
Kendrick sucked in his breath. Chindi were not something he talked about after dark. He knew from his mom's stories that Chindi were all the evils of a Navajo's life that escaped when the soul left to the afterlife. Worse than any Christian devil or Hollywood vampire, Chindi came in the dark to make a person sick, blind, insane, or all three.
What makes you think that? Kendrick asked.
Did the creature make any sounds?
Yes, Kendrick said. It sounded like it was trying to yell. It was like a train whistle or something.
Like it was trying to speak to you? The old man asked.
About what?
Try listening. You'll hear. My auntie could always hear. It might take a few more nights, but you'll understand it. It's already speaking to you, but you can't hear it with your ears yet. You can only hear it with your eyes.
You can't hear with your eyes? Kendrick said.
You can do a lot with your eyes, if you use them. You never saw this creature before this? No strange noises in the room? Not ever?
No, not until after my mom left.
And why did she leave? The hitchhiker said, his face pruned in careful thought.
Kendrick shrugged. Nobody knows.
What if the creature does? That's what my auntie would say.
Who are you? Kendrick asked.
I'm a lot like you. How do they call it? Alne? A half-breed?
The hitchhiker's accent might have been odd, but his Navajo pronunciation was as impeccable as Kendrick's mom's had been. Kendrick guessed he'd lived on or near the reservation for several years.
And I know your mother, although she probably never mentioned an old uncle like me.
How did you know her?
Let's just say we are in the same clan. Towering House, Kiya'ani, one of the first clans made from the body of Asdan Nadlehi, Changing Woman. She's the great mother who gave Navajo women the power of ceremonies, who allowed them to emerge even from death. It was Changing Woman who helped my auntie see what she needed to see with her eyes, ears, and hands. And maybe Changing Woman can have some magic for you tonight.
How? Said Kendrick, the can of Dr. Pepper suddenly heavy in his hand like it was full of pancake syrup. The hitchhiker pinched a fine yellow powder into the top of the can and hummed quietly to himself.
Drink, he commanded, and without thinking, Kendrick tilted the can back and finished it. He stared forward at the tumbling clothes in the dryer and felt himself pulled into them as the colors blended into a dirty gold, the yellow color of pine gum, and the rim of color began orbiting the dark center like the swirling iris of some all-knowing eye that could see, hear, and touch everything.
Kendrick snapped awake after his dad punched his shoulder a fourth time.
You let the clothes run too long, he said, hefting the stuffed laundry sack. He led Kendrick out of the laundromat and lifted himself into the truck. The drive home was quiet, with Kendrick holding the mound of cold laundry on his lap as though it would somehow protect him from what he knew he had to do that night. At the house, he fed the same horses, ate the same frozen dinner, and watched his dad drink the same beers until he lounged limp in his recliner. Before it got dark, Kendrick shot some baskets at the hoop his dad had put up for him on an old telephone pole on the east side of the house last Christmas. His dad was still asleep in the recliner when he entered the house, walked to his room, and lay down to wait for the monster that wasn't a monster. That night, its bristled sagebrush back seemed shorter, like it had been mowed. The creature's snout had shrunk back, and its eyes had become softer and rounder. Kendrick felt small waves of relief when he saw the monster's fingers now ended in rounded human fingernails. Kendrick looked into the monster's almost human eyes and remembered the hitchhiker's words.
What do you want? Kendrick asked.
The creature swayed and held out its arms that seemed softer. It coughed sand with each mouthed syllable. The hitchhiker had told him to expect this when speaking with a Chindi. The monster stepped quietly into the hallway, and Kendrick noticed its hooves had been replaced with delicate, finely haired feet. It led Kendrick through his dad's bedroom door, to the small fire safe beneath his father's toolbox in his closet. The creature's finely fingered hands indicated that Kendrick should open it. After he'd carefully slipped the keys from his dad's belt, Kendrick walked back to his dad's room and opened the fire safe. Inside, next to his parents' passports and a rubber-banded stack of $100 bills, lay a silver and turquoise bracelet with a looping design set with four evenly spaced turquoise stones. It was identical to the one Kendrick wore. The only other like it in this world had been worn by his mother, two of a kind. And she never took it off, not even in the shower, and she always wore it to work. Kendrick shook his head as he took the bracelet. He bit his lip to keep from screaming and crying as the creature led him to the crawl space entrance on the south side of the house. Kendrick brought the flashlight as he crawled into the dark, foot-high space under the floor. He had only crawled 10 feet before he noticed the sand and gravel beneath him was loose. He coughed and dug with his fingers to clear the sand before he grabbed onto something rigid. When he found his mother's hand wrapped in thick, sealed plastic, Kendrick vomited his frozen dinner into the sand. He knew he didn't have to dig for the rest of the body to understand what had happened and why his mom wouldn't be coming home. But before he shuffled out of the crawl space, he placed the silver and turquoise bracelet over the airtight plastic covering his mother's cold, skeletal wrist and replaced the sand over the corpse. Kendrick knew this was the Navajo tradition he and the hitchhiker had discussed. Any jewelry or belongings taken from a corpse was anti, witchcraft. When he emerged beneath the half moon, the monster was gone, but Kendrick knew there was another in the house. He entered quietly and walked to where his dad still flexed and twitched in his recliner, struggling inside some violent dream. His father twitched, whispering incomprehensibly. Somewhere in the violent murmurings, Kendrick could make out a few words. "He's mine, my son, and you won't take him from me." Somehow, Kendrick knew his father wouldn't wake. Not even after he pulled the .45 automatic from his father's jeans.
not even when he aimed the pistol at one of only two faces on Earth that slightly resembled his own. The other face, his mom's, might appear tomorrow night, or the night after, or never. Kendrick didn't know how to handle another night's visit from the Chindi. He cocked back the hammer on the 45. But his father had taught him how to handle monsters. That much he knew.
Those who fight monsters should take care that they never become one. For when you stand and look long into the abyss also looks into you. Long-time listeners will be aware of my occasional fondness for taking an amazingly well-known, iconic quote and going, psh, as if, and that feature will be making a return this week. The abyss isn't somewhere you find yourself. It's somewhere you always are. It's in each and every one of us. Whether you're driven there, or you go there out of choice, there comes a time, unfortunately, there comes multiple times in every single life where you find yourself standing on an edge trying to figure out whether it's better to jump or not. Now, I'm not talking about suicide here. That's very important, and it's much, much more nuanced than the simple binary of life, death, jump, don't jump. We are faced daily with choices that could and do change our lives permanently, and it's all too easy to step away from that, to decide on balance that it's better to put up with what you have than something that might be better. A new job, a new car, a new business opportunity, a new partner, whether you really need that 500-page hardback collection of the first half of Bendis' run on Daredevil. Okay, maybe not that last one, although I do have a birthday coming up. Anyway, the truth is that we have to decide whether to jump or not every single day. And the really irritating thing is the answer is never right and never the same twice. There are times where the equilibrium is all. There are times where you want to jump but shouldn't. And there are times when the only thing you can do is jump and hope for the best. Very, very occasionally, a Vorlon is around for that last one. So, there is no right answer, but that's why things are interesting, because where Nietzsche hit a little to the left, David Bowie hit it dead center. We can be heroes, just for one day, but we can be heroes every single day, if we want to be. We can also dance if we want to, and listen to other podcasts if we want to. Personally, I'd recommend Podcastle, our fantasy show run by Rachel Swirsky and Anne Leckie, and Escape Pod, our sci-fi show fronted by the mighty, mighty Norm Sherman. Both offer the best in their field, for free, on a weekly basis. So do we, of course, but you're here already, so I figured a plug for us would be a little uncouth. We're powered entirely by your unfailing faith in our abilities, sort of like feedback, which is also well worth a listen, by the way, and by donations. Every cent you give us goes to our authors or our server costs, so if you can, and believe me, we do understand if you can't, please either donate or click the PayPal button on the site. We appreciate every single donation we get. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please join us next week for a story simply titled Got Milk? And remember, all Pseudopod knows is he came from the East. They called him the Beast.